We are at the Catamaran Resort in San Diego. This is the third biennial conference of the International Mind Brain Education Society. We've got three of the panelists here. Do me a favor, just introduce yourselves, okay?
Right. I'm Paula Talal. I am the co-director of the Center for Molecular and Behavioral Neuroscience at Rutgers University. And I'm also one of the co-directors of the National Science Foundation-funded Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, one of the Science of Learning Centers.
Right, which we work with, of course.
And I'm Jiaxian Zhou from East China Normal University. I'm the co-founder of Center for Educational Neuroscience. It was launched recently.
Yeah. Nora?
I'm Nora Newcomb. I'm a professor of psychology at Temple University, and I'm the PI of another Science of Learning Center, the Spatial Intelligence and Learning Center.
Okay. How does this all fit together? International Mind, Brain, and Education Society. You certainly work strongly in neuroscience. And there's a B in there which says brain. Mm-hmm. So one thinks that neuroscience must have some important impact on all of this. What's the difference about this society? What's the relationship between this and neuroscience?
Well, the B does stand for brain, stands for neuroscience, but I think the thing that's distinctive about this society is that it tries to bring together the neuroscience with the education and with the mind. So, of course, you know, there's been some debate over the years about do you need the neuroscience or can you just connect mind to education? I think you can connect mind directly to education. I think sometimes you need the brain to make some additional contribution. But what's unique about the society is really the firm eye on the link to education.
Yeah. Paula?
Well, I think that in education, it really helps to understand how the brain really does learn. And what by that I mean, if we can understand in more detail how the brain learns, then we can potentially develop more effective interventions for children who are struggling learners that may not be obvious from the surface. And so I think that I personally don't like distinctions between mind and brain or cognitive science and neuroscience, because we're all of thinking and learning is ultimately involving how our brain functions. And so our brain functions at lots of different levels. Our brain is influenced by everything from our genetic makeup to the environments that we live in. So I think what's unique about this society, and which that I really have hopes for the society, is that rather than trying to create these dichotomies, we're trying to break them down, mm-hmm. and to say we all are interested ultimately in how do you help each child reach their own best potential.
Yeah. In conversations that I've had recently, and you've been involved in this as well with the XPRIZE Foundation in terms of talking about an XPRIZE for neuroeducation, you go to a meeting and there's a whole bunch of people there, and initially the conversation is about getting rid of bad teachers or getting rid of school boards and so on. It's a very convoluted discussion. Until you say to them, what we should be doing is building better learners. How do we build a better learner? How do we optimize this 3 pounds of wonder tissue at the end of your spinal column here? And so brain's obviously hugely important.
Mm-hmm.
Nora,
mm-hmm.
you would agree, I think.
I do.
How does this society work in terms of getting that kind of message across?
Well, I think it would be interesting to hear the perspective on that, because you're also on the board of the society, right?
And, yeah.
And you have the perspective of having the responsibility in your country, in China, for neuroeducation. So it would be really interesting to me to get the international
perspective. Yeah, I'd love to hear what the sense is from China as well.
Oh yeah, recently in China we set up a new Center for Educational Neuroscience, and we invite Stanis Dehan to help us to launch it. And actually, East China Normal University is a comprehensive research university with the educational research, one of the best in China. So in this university, the education and psychology and the brain science is a better subject, is a better discipline in this university. And we integrated these different disciplines together to build educational neuroscience.
Yeah. Nora?
Well, I think there's a tremendous need to have an interdisciplinary attack on the problem of the human mind and how it develops and how it learns. And one of the signal issues in American teaching is the way teachers get prepared. And perhaps in China also, I know one of the people who's at this meeting is concerned with teacher training in Switzerland. It's an international problem. But the way teachers are trained doesn't really prepare them to think about problems like how individual differences work. They tend to take the attitude that, well, oh, it's all genetics, or oh, it's all the parents, or oh, it's all the teacher. And I think the same is true of policymakers. They just don't learn to think with the subtlety that research forces you to think about these issues. And that's what you're seeing when people say, oh, you know, do this, do that, fire the teachers. It's because they don't think with subtlety.
So if I invited all three of you to take over from Arnie Duncan at this point and restructure the educational policy in this country, what would you do?
Well, you could take over this country and I don't know what. You may not know. I mean, there's so many things in American education, some of which are, you know, not addressable by cognitive and neuroscience, like the fact that, you know, schools are supported by the local real estate tax is obviously a very big issue beyond our scope. But I think what I would do, and this is what I was alluding to earlier, is utterly reform pre-service teacher training. I just do not think that teachers understand what they need to understand about how the mind works, how the brain works, how social interaction and culture work. They get terrible preparation.
Paula?
Yeah. I don't know what Paula's answer would be, but.
Yeah, I agree with that. So in my university, we started educational neuroscience for the students. These students will be the future teachers.
Yes.
Yeah, so we think we need to educate them earlier, prepare them to be a good teacher.
Right. Is that unique in your country that you're doing this, or is there kind of a movement that other people, and is it coming from the government? Is it, where? How did this get started? Because it's pretty new, right?
Yeah. And as for the educational neuroscience, we are the first center. So I'm the first teacher to start this kind of courses in China. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm very lucky in Shanghai because the wise mayor Sun Xiaoming paid great attention to educational neuroscience. And actually, he's an expert, studies sleeping. And when he became a mayor in Shanghai City, mm-hmm. and he implement his research into the schools in Shanghai to put to let the students in school to sleep one more hours. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So that became a policy in Shanghai. But as to Taiwan, they told me that it's difficult to implement this policy, this same policy. So it's different. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that brings up an interesting point. I mean, we do learn things from neuroscience that have enormous implications quite broadly. Mm-hmm. For example, the importance of sleep, especially in teenagers. We've known forever, it seems like, that obviously the best time to be learning language is when the brain learns languages. So if you want to teach a child a foreign language, you start very early, not in high school or college. And yet it's very difficult to get them implemented. So I think that if I had the ability to influence public policy, then I would try to focus in two areas. I think that certainly I agree with what's been said already, that preparing teachers for understanding the process that they're going to be responsible for, which is teaching children to learn, at least understanding the science of learning from a variety of perspectives is important. But I also think that what we've learned that's potentially the most important new discoveries in neuroscience pertain to neuroplasticity, mm-hmm. that the brain is not fixed, and that the brain is quite malleable in some very important functions that are really important for learning. How well a child can focus their attention. I remember Michael Posner, who's certainly one of the experts in attention, said attention is learned. I think that is news to a lot of people. They think that children just have more or less attentional capacity, and there's nothing you can do about it. Well, no, it's learned. They have learned to pay attention the way they do because it's adaptive for the brain that they're dealing with. We can, if a child's struggling with attention, we now know enough to create ways of improving attention. Memory span is learned. How fast we process information can be vastly changed. I mean, we're willing to spend all this more money for our computer to make it go faster, to have more memory, whatever, no matter what we want it to do, right?
Yeah, right?
I mean, it doesn't matter if you want a spreadsheet or you want to do search the web or whatever, we all want it faster. Why? Well, I mean, think about it. Why do we want it faster and more memory? Because we can do so much more per unit time. We can glean more information. We can seek information. Well, the brain's the same. You know, so I think that if I had a lot to do with educational policy, I would try to, my goal would be to help the system to understand that increasing and putting effort into increasing the basic fundamental cognitive building blocks of the brain, you know, is critical and needs to be a part of the curriculum, not a supplement. And that when children begin to struggle in some of their main subjects, like literacy and math, that we do know from science that there are some underpinnings and foundational issues that could be strengthened to help those children that don't exactly look like what teachers are used to looking at, like letters and words.
But let's go back to Nora's point. As you know, we just did a meeting on a couple of meetings on music.
Yes.
We talk about rhythms, rhythmicity, timing. I spoke earlier today to Danielle Ansari. We talked about dyscalculia. We talked about numerosity. That's an enormous burden to put on a teacher, isn't it? It suddenly struck me as I went through this, these conversations, of how much they're expected to be able to deliver.
There's
how
a
do you
lot
do
to
that?
Know. Well, it's partly the pre-service education, which I emphasized. Another thing that I think is very important is in-service education. And the in-service sessions that American teachers attend are completely unevaluated and I think are often a waste of time and money. I think that expanding the ability of the scientific community to have outreach through in-service education to practicing teachers is also an enormous frontier. And it's a difficult nut to crack because scientists are busy in the lab producing the new results. They're not very interested in going around to school districts delivering in-service education. So there's a real need, whether it's for electronic delivery systems or, you know, the kinds of things that you produce or various vehicles for bridging that gap. And through vetted, approved, I don't want to have too much bureaucracy here, but there's a lot of not very good information out there that we have to worry about also.
Tell me about your Science of Learning Center, by the way.
Well, the focus of the Spatial Intelligence and Learning Center is on spatial thinking, and it's interesting actually that Paula, you know, mentioned as a lot of people do, you know, verbal facility and numerical expertise. And our idea is not so much that reading, writing, and arithmetic ought to be ought to be augmented by a fourth letter, which would be an S for spatial, three R's plus an S. It's that a lot of the curriculum embodies spatial cognition and that we need to spatialize the curriculum. So math, for instance, the obvious example is geometry, but there's also a lot of use of graphs and diagrams and spatialized information in all of the science disciplines. And people are not very good at reading graphs, at reading diagrams. Teachers often take, this is just one example, but teachers often take diagram reading to be transparent. And in fact, it needs to be taught in the same way that reading needs to be taught. And so that's just one example of the ways in which we think that, you know, some attention to the spatial aspects of the curriculum would be helpful.
Yeah. Is there something, do you do different things differently in China, or is this, are you on the same page with these two?
Yeah, but we begin to the in-service teacher training from last year, yeah, last summer. Professor Sun Xiaoming to give talk to all the teachers, principals, and educational leaders in Shanghai during the summer training.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this summer, he will do this again. Mm-hmm. And in Beijing, we also have trained the primary school and kindergarten school teachers, yeah, mm-hmm. to teach them the brain science, yeah, educational neuroscience. And I think one of the important things is that we need to fight against neural mythologies. There are a lot of mistakes in these areas. Yeah, a lot of mistakes about how to educate the students. Yeah.
There's a document we looked at recently that was given to me by your colleague from Scientific Learning.
Right. From Bill Jenkins, right.
Bill Jenkins about institute in China.
Right. The very, very large initiative in China on basically neuroeducation, and that must be what you're, you know, in charge
of at
some level.
It was very clear from
Very that, clear that they were
that
very
they were basically saying... Mm-hmm. Unless we get this sorted out, I mean, this is a driver for making this country great. This is how we go. This is where we go.
Well, what was interesting is that I think that in my experience, while there's interest in building and enhancing cognitive skills, as it might relate to education, what I got from that document was that there was a fundamental understanding that, as you said, of course we need to enhance the cognitive skills. Of course, now that we know they can be enhanced, this has got to be a mandate for the whole country to increase all of our children's potential, all of our citizens' potential. And it was just a given. And it's whereas here it's still they've embraced that.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question is, you know, as you mentioned, which parts are neuromyth? And so that's where I think it's very helpful to have this collaboration between the actual cognitive and neuroscientists with the teachers to help sort out which parts really are based on solid scientific evidence and which parts are based on some evidence that may have been misinterpreted as it comes to how you might use this in the classroom.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment here. I could come along here and say, you know, in International Mind Brain Education Society, is there too much stress on the evidence from neuroscience? Is that, you know, that we know from published papers that if you show an fMRI scan, that it will attract more public attention and so on, it gets more attention. Is that overdone? I mean, is the brain science good enough to underpin a movement forward in this area?
I think that the presentations at this meeting were not all neuroscience. And in fact, one of the plenary addresses, Hal Paschler's talk, didn't make any use of neuroscience whatsoever. And so, in fact, I think we can get very good purchase on many educational problems through purely behavioral techniques. Even the talks that did make great use of neuroscience techniques additionally used behavioral techniques. And in fact, arguably, the neuroscience would not have been possible to do without the associated knowledge of cognitive science and behavior. In fact, I'm a strong believer in that. So it's an unfortunate aspect of communication that these brain images are so persuasive. And Helen Neville, in fact, mentioned in her address how when she talks to policymakers or parents, it's the brain images that really kind of carry the day, and everyone goes ooh and ah. And that is one of the, on some level, myths that we would need to address, I think, is that that is the only sort of currency of the realm. It's far from it. But they work hand in hand. They're really, you can't have one without the other.
Well, I know that when we were doing our original work on, you know, developing the interventions that derive from our work with children with language learning problems, that and we showed that using neuroplasticity-based training, which is this training that was focused on building these underlying cognitive skills in the context of spoken language in order to improve reading, that everyone was very excited about it, but I was very surprised at the number of scientists who called me up and said, "Did the brain change?" And I, you know, in other words, do you have any evidence of the brain change? Now, of course, I understand what they meant. They were excited about trying this as because using images could, in fact, become a very useful correlate to efficacy studies. You know, if you can show the brain change. But all I'm thinking in my mind is well, what do you think changed their toenails? I mean, the kids' language went up a year or 2 years. Their kids' reading went up. Of course, their brain changed, but now you want to see it now. But what you're saying, Nora, and I completely agree, is that indeed, as soon as the fMRI studies were done and the electrophysiological studies were done, that said, now here specifically is a problem that these children, like Helen Neville showed, with language learning problems, do not show the electrophysiological response in their brain to attention. I mean, on selective attention tasks, it's just gone. And now, after training of this specific type, they do. That's very hard evidence because you can't say, "Well, that was subjective." Mm-hmm. You know. So I agree with Nora, though, that the these techniques. Mm-hmm. I often said that fMRI is not a field of study. Mm-hmm. It's a technique. Mm-hmm. You know, so if it has to be attached to something that's asking very good questions about how the brain processes information, and then it can be an adjunct as a tool.
But how do you get this out to a general public? Let me give you two specific examples. You know, you talked about neuromyths. We did a conversation with Sarah Jane Blakemore some time ago on the Science Network, and she was raging against these neuromyths, the 10% of your brain, and also. Here's a session that was done yesterday, and I talked to Tammy Katzier and Mary Helen Imodina Young, Joanna Christodoulou, the right reading brain. Well, you think from usual public stuff that the left brain does one thing, the right brain does one thing, it's emotional, the left brain is doing the language stuff. This was a very different story.
Did you go to the session?
I was talking to them in the session.
There was very little there was very little evidence in there that it was actually about the right reading brain. I think that was the name of the session. But in fact, did you go?
I went to only the beginning of it, but I did get that same impression.
But my point would be
right.
What do we actually know, and how do we get it out there so that it's not?
But the bigger point is that
baffling
the
people.
Idea that the right hemisphere is the creative one or the emotional one or whatever is basically utterly a neuromyth. Although there's always these little bits of truth in these neuromyths, but the idea that the hemispheres are totally disjoint is a big neuromyth. And the fact that we haven't been able to drive a stake through this vampire's heart is very disheartening. I don't know what to do about it.
But
in fact, if you have damage on the right side of the brain, you're much more likely to end up with an affective, emotional deficit. And if you have deficit, if you have...
That's what I mean. There's kernels of truth to all
of this.
Well,
that's a big truth to me.
Well, no. But what isn't true is something like when educators say, and maybe we disagree about this, when educators say something like, we're only educating the left brain, we should also be paying attention to educating the right brain.
Of course.
What do they possibly mean by that?
Well, this is... All right. You can call that a neuromyth, or you can say that they have only gotten a piece of the information and they've tried to interpret it because we haven't haven't provided them with the education in enough depth. Now, there is some truth to the fact that, you know, that when you have damage in one part of the brain or another part of the brain, that certain things are disrupted. However, it's even more interesting to me that if you're born blind, let's say, that the part of your brain that typically will process visual information will now process auditory information really well. Mm-hmm. So our brains are plastic, and you know, and pieces work together, and you know, so I'm not as disturbed as you are about the quote-unquote neuromyths, because at least it suggests that there's a tremendous interest to understand a little bit more. And that it's our responsibility to provide more detailed information. But it's better than no information. It's not harmful, in my opinion.
But if I then go on to say, well, the left and right hemispheres are connected by this little thing called the corpus callosum.
Yes.
And from what research I've read, there are gender differences in corpus callosum. And if I then go on to say that most of the experimental research I see is done on male animals.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, the thing about it,
I'm not
being on male animals is actually a bit of a sore point.
I mean, but
there was a time when male humans were more studied than female humans. Luckily, that's now the Dark Ages. But the reason supposedly is because female mammals at least cycle, and the animal researchers don't want to worry about that. But I actually have done a little bit of mouse research in which we have included female mice. It's not that much of a big deal. I personally think this is a prejudice on the part of animal researchers.
Well, it's interesting. Holly Fitch at UConn, University of Connecticut, has done some really interesting work that is looking at this rat model of dyslexia, basically. Right. And it's like, rat model of dyslexia? What are you talking about? Well, there are hormonal differences, there are processing differences, there are these ectopic parts, you know, lesions that... So you can create this model animal. They're not really dyslexic, of course. But what's interesting is that she finds that you get similarities between the kinds of processing deficits that you see in dyslexics, but only in the male rats. Not in the female rats. And so the gender difference that you see in human dyslexics, which is more males than females, also shows up in these animal studies where you're really mimicking the neurobiological differences. And they've also seen this in the genetic, they've made these genetically, the mice knockouts, right, that are based on the genes that have been located for certain kinds of disorders. And it's only males again. And the females don't show the problem. You know, and the problem, you know, the problem's rapid auditory processing.
I guess the point I was making there was that still a lot of confusion.
Yes, of course. So, and I'm not trying to say that I think that half information is better than no information. Sometimes it can be. Sometimes it can be. You know, it could be detrimental for sure.
Right.
But I think that a lot of the people who have really tried to step into the role of translating the neuroscience to educators are getting a lot of bad press for not being, perfect, where at least they're trying to fill a role. And if neuroscientists want to do that or cognitive scientists want to do that, hopefully we will find some people within the field to do that.
Right. And I think people are starting to want to do a better job of that.
Yeah.
Even people who formerly would have thought of themselves as, I'm just a research scientist, why should I talk to the public?
Yeah.
I think that is starting to change.
But don't you think that's important? I mean, one of the questions that I ask all the people, you've seen this, some of this before, I've done this with Paula before, of course, the role of science in society, the whole burden of what the Science Network is about. he comes into office and he says, my administration will restore science to its rightful place. What's the rightful place of science?
Well, obviously he thought it was a more central place than it had. But what do you mean by, I'm not sure I understand the question, what is
what
the
do you
rightful
think is the,
place?
What do you think is the rightful place of science in this society?
Well, so you probably don't want to hear my answer because I think it's absolutely central. I think nothing, almost nothing could be more important. Now, I say that with a little bit of tongue in cheek because I recognize that it has to be filtered through sort of morality and values and ethics to make good policy. But scientific innovation is what drives our economy. It's what allows for better health care. It's not just in the realm of education that I think it's central. It's hard for me to think of a more important or nobler calling than being a scientist. And I hate to say that. It sounds so vain.
No.
I really mean it.
Yeah. Would you give the same answer from China?
Yes.
It's so central?
Yeah.
And we've talked about this before, so.
It also has to do with science is about asking questions and understanding what constitutes evidence. Mm-hmm. And from that, trying to get closer and closer to reality or the facts. And so a society that is restoring science to its rightful place would be one in which evidence helps drive opinion and helps drive policy and helps drive, the future. And so to me, I mean, I agree completely with Nora. It has nothing to do with what my profession is. It has to do with a broad sense of what happens to societies when opinion becomes equal to fact. And I think one of the things that goes on with the press is that in any topic that's controversial, first of all, they love it. But secondly, they think that in order to be fair, you have to give both sides of the argument equal weight. Mm-hmm. And so you might say, okay, I'd like to hear from, Nobel Prize winner, blah, 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 on this mm-hmm. topic. Yeah. And now I want to hear from Mr. Smith on his opinion. You know, and then somehow they're made to be, it's almost like the press has decided that to be non-biased, you have to have these equal opinions, and they're not equal.
The late Senator Daniel Daniel Patrick Moynihan used to say that everyone's entitled to their own opinion but not their own facts.
Right.
So,
and now, understanding the difference is what science is all about.
All right.
Okay.
Let me get some background. I like to ask people out there how they actually got into this trajectory. I mean, did you have a scientific parents? Background? Was it a book? Was it a teacher?
Well,
why are you doing what you're doing?
Both my parents had PhDs in chemistry.
Oh my gosh.
So I was sort of the person who didn't go into science as they defined it. I kind of was a backslider that way. And one of my two brothers also has a PhD. He does plant genetics. So my other brother, who's a lawyer, likes to say he's the only, really non-success in the family.
What about you?
My parents are teachers. And my husband is genetics. And he often talk about his discipline to me. So I'm getting interested in these areas. Yeah. And also when I was a doctor student, I involved in a big project to design the curriculum policy in China. So at that time, I'm very interested to know how the science say about how the students learn, how we design the educational policy based on mind-brain research. So I'm very interested in these areas from that time. But compared to China and America, and I think America go ahead in China That is, you have no child left behind the act, which you put emphasis to the evidence-based education. But in China, it is 10 years now that we come to know that evidence-based education is very, very important. Yeah.
Nora and Paula, you're both running, you're both part of National Science Foundation funded Science of Learning Centers. If I think back, there was a man called Vannevar Bush, who was an advisor to FDR, and then later put in a report to Harry Truman, and suggested the setting up of a National Science Board, which became the National Science Foundation. He and a couple of other people were basically running science policy at that point. In terms of the how science policy is construed, do you think the current setup is ideal or?
Of the foundation?
Do you find there's too much interference? Do you find there's enough funding? What's your sense of the relationship between government and science and research at this point?
Well, funding has been an issue. There are periods where it has been expanding, but it's obviously under pressure now, given tough economic times. But one of the things that's a specific concern is that the social, behavioral, and economic sciences at NSF are in their own directorate. They weren't, but they became so, I forget, maybe 15 or so years ago. And that, on the one hand, elevated their profile, which I think was a good idea, but on the other hand, it's exposed them to tremendous criticism, intermittent criticism from Congress. And in fact, there is currently an attack, which just came out, looking through a lens at the National Science Foundation, which yet again, and this happens periodically, recommended zero funding for the social, behavioral, and economic sciences. There are specific projects that get singled out for ridicule, going back to Proxmire, but this has happened yet again.
His Golden Fleece Award thing.
His was the Golden Fleece Award, but this is happening yet again. So I think it is problematic as to whether or not our disciplines are considered science and whether they are considered deserving of funding. Yeah. It's quite unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean the reason I drew that parallel, of course, was that in those days, whatever Bush or the president of Harvard said was automatically put into place.
Something interesting about Bush, which I didn't realize. One of the things that he did before he wrote the report that started NSF is
Memex.
What?
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about
Memex. It's to take penicillin and make it something that every guy who landed on the beaches at Normandy had penicillin in his pouch kind of thing. Because 4 years before that, you couldn't get it for, all the gold in the world.
He also had this idea called Memex, which
that
was...
That I didn't know that.
He imagined this... He was talking about microfiche. At that time, he imagined that there may be a room-sized area where he could put all the world's information and access it. It's Google. It's the World Wide Web.
Yeah. No, I didn't know about that.
So far ahead of his time.
Yeah, he was in many ways. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But your personal, trajectory through this. I mean, why did you end up doing the things you're doing right now?
Well, I guess I was a pretty standard cognitive developmental researcher, I got increasingly interested in education as I saw my kids go through the educational system. That is really the truth. I kept looking at what
desperation?
I don't know, they did fine, and it wasn't that kind of thing. It was more that I constantly saw ways in which I thought things could be better, and my kids went to really good schools. I mean, this is not a criticism of their schools, of their teachers. It's just a criticism of the ways in which teachers are able to get information, make use of the information they get, the ways in which, you know, school boards operate. Just really little anecdotes. So for instance, kindergarten teacher of my acquaintance said she didn't like to show maps to kids because it wasn't developmentally appropriate. They couldn't make any sense of maps. Mm-hmm. And I do spatial research. I knew perfectly well that they could make some sense of some maps, and that were they to be shown simple maps, they would build their ability to make use of more complex maps, mm-hmm. were you only to have shown the simple maps. So that's just one anecdote. There were so many anecdotes like that. It sort of got to be too much for me. I kind of wanted to do something about it.
How was your experience?
Well, my experience was that I was an art history major. I know that.
I recall that, yeah.
Yeah. But I lived really near the Rockefeller University, and I needed to work my way through college. So I went and got myself a job, and it turned out I had a job in a animal behavior lab, and I learned how to do lots of animal behavior research and got hooked. And so I also was able to meet the chairman of the Department of Psychology at Oxford, who convinced me that I really shouldn't go into art history, I should go into science, and that I really had a mind for it. And so it's a bit of a strange experience. But actually, I also was very fortunate. I had a grandfather who was a physician and an aunt who was a physician and a scientist. And so I saw that as some way in which you could affect the world in a positive way. So I did have very good role models. I was really lucky. And one of the things is my aunt got me a job. I think you probably have this on tape once before, but my aunt got me a job one summer in a chemistry lab.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And it took me the entire summer to figure out the reason I was messing up all the experiments was that pipettes actually came in different sizes. And I figured chemistry wasn't my calling. Uh-huh. And so then I also had a job in a hospital. And I ended up as an intern, unpaid intern, on the aphasia ward with adults. And these are adults who had lost their ability to speak because they had had strokes.
Right.
And I thought that was the worst possible thing that could ever happen to a person, and that there was nothing that I could study that would be more important than language and what happened and how the brain controls language and language abilities. And then when I found that there were children who didn't learn language, they didn't have strokes, but for some unknown reason they weren't learning to talk appropriately, and the enormous impact that would have on every aspect of their life, from social interactions, from parents and siblings and peers, through academic achievement, and you know, just the snowballing effect of that, I just couldn't think of anything more important to spend my life working on than trying to understand how that could possibly happen. And that's sort of, I'm kind of like one foot in front of the other. I've been doing the same thing since I've been doing my thesis at Cambridge all this time.
Uh-huh.
And it's, you know, still the most fascinating topic I know.
So young people going into this field right now, getting some sense of the history of it, the context of it, how you advise them. Peter Medawar's book, Advice to a Young Scientist. What's your advice to a young scientist?
I think this is a tremendously exciting time to go into this field. It's really just creating itself. It's very much in flux right now. I think that it's going to be increasingly an area of opportunity as universities kind of adjust their structure a little bit to allow for it to have a more comfortable home. And I think that in terms of methods and techniques, we're poised on the brink of making tremendously exciting discoveries. We've made some already, but we're going to make so many more discoveries in the next 10 to 20 years.
Yeah.
It's going to be incredible.
But what do you have to do? What do you have to do to be a good?
Well,
what do you need? What's the cognitive kit that you need to bring to being a successful young scientist?
I'm a little bit lost for words because I'm not sure what you mean. I think more than anything, you need passion. You need the ability to ask good, clear questions. You have the ability to know when a good, clear question can be answered given current techniques and when it cannot be answered right now, unfortunately. There's so many. I could go on and on.
I often ask young scientists, why out of all the questions in the world that you could spend your time on, do you pick this one?
Yeah. Interesting.
Especially really young scientists. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think that they realize many times that what you are picking, your selection of questions matters probably as much, if not more, mm-hmm. than in terms of how important are they. Mm-hmm. You know, and especially when you hear some student's thesis, sometimes you go like, why did you decide to spend 4 years asking this question? Where is it going to lead?
Right.
So, not that I think that you always have to have an applied goal to your work at all. I don't believe that at all. But I think that really it's important to really think about what's worth your while to use all the education you're getting to what kinds of questions really matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think?
And I think the persistent is also very important.
Yeah.
They need to stick on it for many years. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Didn't Freud define maturity as being able to give up the immediate pleasures for long-term goals? I think scientists have to have enormous amount of maturity. Because our goals are much longer term, I think, than most other professions.
Where do you see this field going? Anybody? If you have an international mind, brain, and education society, you assume it has a mission.
Right.
You assume it has some objectives.
Uh-huh.
You assume that it wants to get somewhere. What kind of vision is involved here?
Well, I think the objective is to delineate principles of human learning and how those are embodied in the brain that is the mind, and to delineate ways in which this can be used educationally. That is very global, and we need to do that for very specific domains. So the principles that are true for reading might not be the same principles that are true for math, and math is not all one thing. There's a lot of work to be done, but the overall goal is this goal of understanding principles of learning, the ways the mind works, and that can transcend, you know, what very often people mean when they talk about evidence base is they'll take some intervention, you know, intervention A, B, C, and they'll say, well, does it work? Well, maybe it works. Maybe it works better than a control group. Maybe it works better than intervention, you know, PQR. But if we don't know why it works and how it works and for whom it works, then we don't know very much at all. And we're kind of condemned to be rats running around endlessly evaluating interventions as black boxes. So I want to get kind of inside the black box and understand how and why things work and don't work.
Oh, I think the mission is to, to me, the mission is to make, to have every teacher recognize that they in their own right are a scientist every day. In the way in which they approach their students to figure out what's
think going. Think like a scientist.
Think like a scientist in terms. Yeah, and then I know what I was going to say. It's back. motivation. I just think that motivation is so critically important to learning. Well, and I wanted to go into this idea that to be motivated, what does that really mean, and how do we make, some people love to learn, And I think most children actually begin loving to learn.
But we're talking about this whole notion of being addicted to learning.
Well, that's what I'm getting to.
Neural correlates of engagement.
Yes,
right?
That's exactly right. So, I mean, you were talking about, you know, reading and math and various other things, but underneath all of it, that has a bigger picture to me, is how do we develop a society from teachers to the children themselves, mm-hmm. to people in general, mm-hmm. who find learning and seeking out information mm-hmm. to be pleasurable in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Not because you're going to pass the test or because mommy said to or because I'm going to make, you know, daddy happy, but because it makes my brain feel good. It makes me feel safer in the world when I know things. It makes me feel mm-hmm. more that the world is more exciting. Mm-hmm. So to me, understanding that, I mean, to me, that's the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. If we could understand how it is that brains, as we call it, become addicted, you know, why can't we use this addiction to video game to be addicted to understand how to addict children to actually loving information seeking for its own right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, to me, that's a very exciting mm-hmm. area. And I would say ultimately, that pulling together education and cognitive science and neuroscience, whatever you want to call it, mind-brain education, that's one of the big goals, is to understand how it is that we love education. How is it that we can make more people or help more people to love what the feeling in their brain when they predicted that something was going to happen and it happened? You know, I wanted to find it. I found it. It's exciting. It makes things fall into place more for me in the world. It makes me able to cope with the world I live in at all sorts of different levels.
Okay, so let me ask all three of you. What are you optimistic about?
Well, I'm actually really optimistic that we will be able to put together different levels of understanding. So the relationship, which is going to be tremendously complex, between you know, genomics and epigenesis and you know, all these other, you know, and the neural and the behavioral and the developmental and the various kinds of environmental input, I think we are actually going to be, in the end, able to make a lot of sense of this. And it will be a complex story, but I think when we can tell it, it may be simpler than we think it's going to be. And I don't know. I'm not sure I'm going to live to read this book, though. But I think that in a couple of decades, we'll be getting there.
And also, I think this society gives us a very good platform to organize all these people together with different backgrounds to share their ideas, how to teach the students.
I'm optimistic that there is a society like this, and that that we're
trying these issues.
That can address these issues, mm-hmm. and that we have. I'm optimistic when I see the younger students who are involved in this field coming up, because they will not have the constraints for putting the information together that I think my generation has had. I'm a little pessimistic when I hear some of the old arguments creeping in, or tensions creeping in, about is it neuroscience that can help education, or is it cognitive science that can help education? I hope that doesn't become an issue inside any society, or in fact the whole field, because what we call it isn't as important as how we're educating students to think more globally about understanding the, you know, the value of science itself and how we understand learning. I don't care whose territory it is.
Thank you all very much.
Oh, well,
thank you.
Thank you, Roger. That was great.